I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
What happens when you screw with the wrong people? Terrible Tommy here. Terrible Tommy's here in the bunker, right here with about 4 inches of new snow on the ground here in north central Indiana. Warsaw, Indiana, to be exact. And we're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, 46581. That's where you send your donations for January, the show. And we've gotten quite a number of them in already, so that's good. Don't forget to paint resist.com all over the walls around town. And then if you're a construction worker, resist.com in the crapper. Yeah, let's get the word around. These people need some education. Better education they get from the right or the left wing. Yeah. Well, I see the boys are getting all excited up in Oregon. Here we go again. Another batch of guy's going to end up in the hooskow or dead because they got this idea that they can all gather in one place and fight the system. And then now they're calling for people to come there from all over the country. And that's either out of stupidity or actual agent provocateur. But they don't learn, and I can advise them, but they never listen. And then I'm getting letters from them later from prison. Gee, I didn't know I should have listened to you. Yeah. Look, it's way too soon for that kind of stuff. It'll come sooner or later, but it's way too soon right now. You got to wait till this ISIS thing and all this Middle East crap beats up on these people quite a bit, which it will. They just don't get it. The federal government, they just don't get it. They're going to keep playing the game, playing Russian roulette, because they can make lots of money on weapons and so forth. But the time when things are going to go really bad for them is around the corner. I can't give you a date, but that's what's coming. And it's also unnecessary. If you had any kind of brains in the State Department and so forth, all this could have been avoided. How? Well, not starting wars, not invading and occupying countries. People don't like that, no matter what color they are, and they're going to come back at you. You know, they sure are. And they've got the luxury, they can strike anytime. They can hit you any time of the week or on Sunday or on a holiday or light your big hotels on fire. They can do whatever they want to, and they don't care if it takes 50 years. Don't bother them. Here's a funny blurb I listened to. You get some funny stuff out of these so-called conservatives, because they're not conservatives at all. What the hell are they trying to conserve? I mean, you know, you got liberal conservatives, and you got conservatives, Got neon conservatives. Listen, neo-conservatives. Listen to these guys.
Let's go to George in Tennessee.
866-957-2874. Let's go to the phones. And let's go to George in Tennessee. George in Tennessee, you're on Breitbart News Daily. How can I help you, sir?
Yes, everybody's mad at Lee Zeldin. I mean, I just heard the last few callers. I listened to your weekend show. The only thing I have to ask and everything, the people that are running for office, have them define their conservatism. Because I read an article here not too long ago, and I heard it on the radio, that conservatism swings just about liberal all the way over to the right. So that was one of my biggest things when that people say, well, I'm conservative, and I'm running for office, and I'm the top conservative. If you guys remember, John McCain said he was conservative. Lindsey Graham said that they were conservative. And everything, and we actually see that they're not. So just have them define it so all of us and everything will understand where exactly where they are.
George, that's absolutely brilliant. That's that kind of basic American common sense that just...
That's what counts with Breitbart for being brilliant. That's brilliant. Would you define your conservatism? Well, of course they're going to lie to you anyhow. What do you want them to say? They'll say it until they get into office, and then they'll screw you, and they always do. So here's these people who think they're still conservatives. I don't know what the hell they think they are out there arguing and talking about this stuff, and if you try to interject something about, well, maybe we ought to see what about saving the race a little bit here, they kick you right off the air. You get off my radio show, you racist bastard. Yeah. Oh man, these kind of people drive me up the walls. I don't think there's been any real conservatives who are around for about 50, 60 years in this country. And even then, a lot of them were screwed up. I know, I lived through it. I had to work with these people, try to get something going. And nothing ever got going, really. It's pretty much been a waste of time. And you know this guy that's a talker on this Breitbart show? He's getting pretty popular with the whatever you want to call him. He's graduate of Harvard. He's out of Harvard. Does anything ever come good for us out of Harvard? I don't think so. There's some more of that pro-Israel BS. They got their this right-wing outfit. They got their news bureau guy over there in Israel now, so you can tell which side he's on. Sounds like things are heating up over there a little bit again, and can you imagine they won't give the bodies back to the Palestinians that were killed by the Israeli army? They won't give them back, the bodies. That reminds me of a scam that started a long time ago called embalming in that kind of business that started at the Civil War. A lot of people don't know that. Problem was, you put a body in a coffin and transport it a few hundred miles back home. By the time it gets there, it's nothing but a bunch of blob. Well, this guy got a fancy idea to make some money, so he started this thing where he would embalm these people, these soldiers from the Civil War, and send them back that way. So they'd get back there, they'd look somewhat like they did when they were alive. I don't think very much, because it probably shot to shit when they went into the coffin. Anyhow, the whole embalming thing is a big scam. People make all kinds of profits off war. Every little thing they can find, they'll build it into a money-making deal. I'll play this clip from this Breitbart guy over in Israel.
And Israel, all the angst And the, I would say, saber rattling that we heard at the last Republican debate about Russia in Syria and the implications that has for the region, Russia's intervention in the Syrian civil war. It's very interesting. I've been in Israel about 10 days now. The Israelis have a very different take on the Russian involvement in Syria's civil war than do most Americans, particularly of the neoconservative variety. I think it's safe to say that most Israelis that I've spoken to, geostrategists and politically astute folks who understand the thinking of the Israeli military and most of the security establishment here, I wouldn't go so far as to say they're perfectly fine with Russia in Syria, but they're pretty close to being perfectly fine with Russia in Syria, because Israelis always look at realities and try to measure them not against utopian ideals, but against other realities. And the options in this neighborhood, in this part of the world, are always pretty crappy. So with Russia in Syria, what it means to most Israelis is that Iran cannot completely take over Syria. The Russians wouldn't tolerate it. And Iran, of course, is Israel's mortal enemy, its primary foe. And if Iranian suzerainty, control over Syria, became complete, Iran would have a direct access border with Israel. And nobody wants that. Nobody around here wants that. So if the Russians are able to keep the Iranians at bay, then the Israelis are at least prepared to tolerate the Russians. And that's very interesting. You don't hear that perspective talked about much in the Republican establishment, Chris Christie and others promising immediate shootdowns if no-fly zones that are proclaimed and protected by the United States are violated by the Russians. A couple of weeks back, during a Russian airstrike, two Russian MiGs, for simply a matter of mere seconds, crossed into Turkish airspace, and both of those planes were shot down. One pilot killed. We don't know what happened to the other. All kinds of conflicting reports. And ever since then, Turkey's really been on edge, because Turkey has now pulled the whiskers of the Great Bear, and the Russians are primed to hit back. You don't smack Vladimir Putin in the face and expect not to be hit in return. So the Turks are really on edge, waiting for some kind of response from Russia, which hasn't come yet. And they don't know what that's going to be or where that's going to be. And Turkey, of course, now has a president, former prime minister, Recep Erdogan, an Islamist, the head of the AKP party, who's been in power for a long time, about 12 years, was prime minister for 10 years, has now been president for a year, year and a half, and is trying to change the constitution of his country for the president, which was primarily a ceremonial position, to become the real power broker and power dispenser in the country.
Yada, 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 yada. They all go on. Spin, 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 spin. Well, of course, the Jews over there in Israel, they're going to do whatever they want to do and feel they got to do. Of course they're going to, because they got one foot on a banana peel and the other in the grave over there. Well, let's face it, boys and girls, our so-called leaders in this country have fucked up the Middle East, and it's not going to straighten out. It's not going to get better. I mean, we're talking about 20, 30, 40 years here with our stupid presidents and stupid Congress, along with that British idiot, Blair, and those guys. They screw up anything. I'm telling you. This country has nobody as a real enemy except itself. And it's going to get worse before it gets better. That's why I say just stay away from the system. Don't play with the system at all. Take care of your own situation. Build your own gates and walls. And try to weather the storm. Because if you jump in and start playing politics with these people, it's going to get really nasty in this country. The right wing is starting with a big push on the guns again. They're going to take the guns. All they have to do is say one little thing in Washington about we need to have some control over guns, and they go crazy. They got Obama's going to do an executive order and take the guns. So how are they going to take the guns? I mean, I'm sure they could try, but I think they know better to try to take the guns. But the right wing uses that, and the NRA uses that for power and bringing in money and all that. Donations, man. Nothing brings in donations like, they're going to take your guns. Out Nick is going to take your guns. And those guys and those Democrats and stuff, they're going to take your guns. Horse shit. Some guy's written a book about Vladimir Putin, and I got just the tail end of this statement. It was pretty good. You know, he was a station man with the KGB in East Germany at the time when everything started falling apart. And the East Germans invaded the offices of the Stasi and took everything and got the papers and all the secret files and everything. But they came around to the KGB, and guess who was in charge? Putin was in charge. This is sort of funny. Listen to this.
Inside, he had been told by the story of how, as they were demanding essentially to be allowed in, they encountered this lone officer who came out, who turned out to be Vladimir Putin.
Mm-hmm.
And in his case, he had already been calling to the military, the Soviet military base there, for reinforcements. He wanted a troop carrier or something to come and protect his building from being overrun with all of its files inside. He had been told by the officer that he reached at the base that he was waiting for instructions, and he kept calling back. And finally, the guy said, "Moscow is silent." And he couldn't do anything without orders in the Soviet Union, of course. And so Putin faced this incredible dilemma. What does he do with this mob outside? And he walked out alone, unarmed, and it was a December night. It was cold, and he bluffed. He told the people outside that he had orders that the guards inside would open fire if anyone tried to storm the building. And the guy
was... Did the people outside know the building was KGB?
Of course they did, yeah. I mean, it was like it was an open secret, I guess is how you would put it. And I don't think there was a big KGB sign. but that... His words, I mean, in perfect German, were so resolute, you know, not alarming. He didn't shout. He didn't menace. But he just spoke with such authority, which he did not have, by the way, that the crowd thought, yeah, we're having enough fun with the Stasi files right now. We don't need to pick a fight with the Soviet Union. And he managed to, you know, keep control of the building through that, which was a heroic deed in a way. And yet, a terrible, embittering experience for him, because he felt like his own government, the Soviet government, that is, had collapsed. He calls it a disease, a paralysis of power. And, you know, Gorbachev, of course, at that time was disengaging from the Soviet experiment, if you will, in Eastern Europe. And eventually the Soviet Union itself would collapse, something that he said he saw that night. He foresaw the end of the Soviet Union because of this irresolution.
And he didn't seem very happy about it.
No, not at all. And his friends, and he himself, his wife Ludmila, and his friends often talked about this as being something that he felt incredibly bitter about. He felt it was a betrayal of the Stasi, specifically, that people that they had collaborated with, that they had worked with as intelligence agents, you know, that we just left our allies behind and turned them over to the West and to NATO, essentially. And that experience has been with him a long time. And you feel it even now in the actions in Syria, that, you know, the Russian state cannot allow the mob to run over, the legitimate authority.
It seems to have informed most of his larger acts for the rest of his career up until now. And I want to skip ahead, with that in mind, I want to skip ahead to his election when he was coming into power in Moscow, taking over for Yeltsin, and just some of the atmospherics that you write about in the book. This is from the New Czar. And I've just highlighted something there.
With the duties of the presidency already his, Putin eschewed overtly political events during the short campaign. He held no rallies, gave no speeches, and refused to participate in debates with his challengers. Reflecting his dour character and disdain for retail politics, he was redefining the modern campaign in Russia in his own image and in ways that would stifle the democratic future the fall of the Soviet Union had seemed to usher in. Within days of becoming acting president on New Year's Eve, Putin had co-opted his main potential rivals, tilting the playing field sharply in his favor.
So he never, between the fall of the Berlin Wall and his ascension to power, he had never come to embrace the tenets of democracy.
You know, an interesting point we haven't talked about yet is when he came back from East Germany, recalled, like all of the other officers.
Well, what was there left to do?
All across Eastern Europe. He actually took up in Leningrad, now renamed St. Petersburg, with one of the country's leading Democrats, a guy named Anatoly Sobchak, who was an ally of Boris Yeltsin, and was seen as, in fact, a potential president of all of Russia, and had been a real champion early on of the democratic transition. So in a way, he had that introduction to democracy. But in the 90s, democracy, or at least the freedom or the class of the Soviet Union, brought chaos. It brought criminality. It was a period that was so fraught and confused that a lot of Russians, not just Putin, saw it as chaos. They saw it as a transition to something worse.
And the rise of the oligarchs, too.
The rise of the oligarchs is definitely part of it. And it didn't seem at first, anyway, to usher in a promising future at all. And yet he stuck very loyally with Sobchak and served him loyally.
Deputy mayor?
He rose eventually to become the deputy mayor and then first deputy mayor.
he was in charge of attracting foreign economic investment in Petersburg. He did do quite a lot of that. He was involved in some shady deals. There were accusations of corruption in some of those deals, and in the and since in the companies and kind of contracts that were given out during Sobchak's reign. But Sobchak, though seen also as an authoritarian, much the way that Yeltsin also was later on, you know, he faced re-election, stood for re-election, and to Putin's dismay, another of the deputy mayors challenged him. And so his first experience of a genuine campaign, mind you, Putin never ran for office for anything himself. He was appointed deputy mayor. His first experience of a campaign was an act of betrayal by one of his colleagues, challenging a man he really quite adored. They were very close. And even worse, the deputy won. Sobchak lost the election.
Mm-hmm.
And Putin couldn't understand how could such a good man, you know, actually lose. And I think that almost as much as anything shaped his idea. When Yeltsin appointed him first to be prime minister in 1999, his first reaction was, I don't like elections. I don't like campaigns. And Yeltsin told him, no, you don't have to worry about that. We have people who do that. and he's kind of stuck with it. And, you know, he never genuinely engaged in a debate, if you will, with a challenger, with the opposition. Even from the very first election, where I think there was still more competition. This would have been in 2000. In terms of people at the time still thought the Communist Party might make a recovery as a kind of social democratic party. But by the time he ran, he had so dominated the political space already that he didn't really need to, you know, face any of the challengers or take them on or really have a debate with them at all. And from that point on, you've not seen any of that happening. Sometimes the opposition candidates who are allowed to run, and from the, they call them the loyal opposition, they'll have debates amongst themselves. And meanwhile, Putin will be on TV every night taking care of the nation's business. And so Russians then see what passes for an election campaign as just a farce, a meaningless gesture to ratify the leader who's already in place.
We have to take a break. I'll be back with Stephen Lee Myers. The book is The New Tsar, The Rise and Reign of Vladimir Putin. Stephen Lee, 26-year career at the New York Times. Hopefully this won't be the end of it. The way he really just delved into some really dark stuff, the secrecy, suspicion, scandal, dirty tricks, street assassinations, and the backdrop, which you keep returning to, in your book, the trouble in Chechnya, which just from the beginning to the end of the book is just this sort of dark, burbling thing that sometimes percolates up, but is always behind in the background for Putin.
The first war in Chechnya happened during Yeltsin's time in the early 90s and was seen as a catastrophic failure for the Russian military. They essentially got their clocks cleaned. And when Putin came back, that war had ended in a ceasefire in 96, but it had never been resolved. And the question of Chechen independence was very much a heated issue at the time of that he came in. And there were a series of attacks across the border out of Chechnya first, and then a series of apartment bombings, which some people have suggested were part of the conspiracy to bring Putin to power. And Putin's response when he became prime minister, just as all this was beginning to happen, surprised everyone. Because rather than no one in the Russian elite wanted a war in with Chechnya again. They wanted it to be contained and just not.
Well, the economy was a mess, right?
The economy was a mess, but also that it had been so unpopular, the first war. It had really dragged down Yeltsin's presidency. And Putin's reaction to this was he was going to resolve it. He was convinced, or at least says he was, when he was first appointed as prime minister, that he didn't have long in office. And no one else thought he had long in office, because if you remember, Yeltsin was appointing a prime minister every few months at that point. And they thought this guy, Putin, would just be another one of those. But he reacted so forcefully to the violence in Chechnya and had started a second war and vowed to finish it. He famously said that if they found terrorists in the outhouse, they would waste them there. And suddenly, this was amazingly popular. The Russian people, ordinary people, cheered him on. They wanted this crisis in Chechnya, this humiliation, this defeat, to be avenged. And he vowed, and through a long, brutal war, was able to crush the separatist movement in Chechnya, putting in place a former rebel who had also broken with the more radical aspects of Chechen independence movement, and then his son, who's now still in control. And they rule Chechnya with an iron fist, almost like a personal fief now, and yet it's contained the worst of the violence anyway.
So 2000 was the beginning of the Putin era in Russia. He kicked it off with a New Year's Eve address. And that was the beginning. And of course, as you mentioned, he was out of power during the rule of Medvedev. Am I saying that right?
He never really left power.
No.
I mean, he remained the paramount leader of the country, but at least officially, he deferred the office to Medvedev.
We mentioned early on that at 9/11, Putin asked, "How can we help the Americans?" He seemed very disturbed by it. He said, "You read that he was the first world leader to call the White House, and of course he had already met Bush in June of 2001 in Slovenia, the famous looked into his eyes." I wonder if you'd be kind enough to read this graph about Putin's return to power in 2012. This comes towards the end of your book, and it really seems to me to define not just what went before, but also what we're seeing now.
After returning to power in 2012 with no clear purpose other than the exercise of power for its own sake, Putin now found the unifying factor for a large, diverse nation still in search of one. He found a millenarian purpose for the power that he held, one that shaped his country greater than any other leader had thus far in the 21st century. He had restored neither the Soviet Union nor the Tsarist Empire, but a new Russia with characteristics and instincts of both. With himself as secretary general and sovereign, as indispensable as the country itself was exceptional. No Putin, no Russia. He had unified the country behind the only leader anyone could now imagine, because he was, as in 2008 and 2012, unwilling to allow any alternative to emerge. That reference to no Putin, no Russia was something that his chief of staff essentially actually his political strategist, said after the events in Ukraine and the annexation of Crimea. He said that there is Russia and there is Putin, and without Putin there's no Russia. I mean, he's seen by his loyalist as being indispensable, as the country could not exist without him. And that's what that was a reference to.
Does Russia need a strong man?
You know, a lot of people say yes. A lot of Russians say yes. I think a lot of, I mean, it helps explain his popularity, which I think is genuine, though exaggerated.
What about all those protests, though?
The protests were an expression of disgust with the election process at the time, and they were sizable, but they also weren't very effective, and they were easily put down, essentially strangled, slowly suffocated out. They arrested the leaders of them. They, you know, put constraints on how you could protest. They increased fines for protesting, and slowly but surely, you know, they dissipated, and he essentially rode them out. And since then, you've seen occasionally protests against various aspects. There was a peace march after the war in Ukraine started, but they never again reached the level they did there for a while. And right now, especially after the annexation of Crimea, for all of the controversy that has caused around the world, that was an enormously popular gesture at home, widely appreciated. And that drove his approval ratings, which seemed to at one point have been sinking, right back up to stratosphere.
Seems to have been at least part of the point. We have time for, I think, a couple questions. I have a few on Twitter here. Douglas Trapasso, that we have Demi love, Stephen, wants me to ask you, what is your honest assessment of Putin's health, and has he thought about a successor?
He has always been very fit, and made a point of that, of exercising even recently on TV with Medvedev, and swimming and riding horseback, shirtless. So part of that is the image building. Part of that's vanity, frankly. But he has always been somebody who was in good shape. He didn't smoke. He doesn't drink much. So compared to typical Russian male, I assume he's got a few years left in him. There have been periodically rumors of, you know, ill health, maybe something wrong with him. Those have never been substantiated. And
there's always rumors about him. There were rumors that he was gay.
There's, you know, part of it is that so little is known independently about him. You know, that people kind of project things based on slivers of, you know, information or just pure gossip. You know, I think part of that is the aura, the mystique, that the czar surrounds himself with. They often will let things kind of pass, you know, questions of his wealth. You know, they deny periodically, but not very convincingly sometimes. You know, rumors of affairs with various women have come up over the years, and they sort of deny them or indirectly deny them or dismiss them as...
How bad is that for a Russian politician to have affairs with a gymnast?
I don't think it affects... I don't think the electorate in Russia, if you want to call it that, is quite the same as it is in the United States, or Europe for that matter.
Another question here from Dave Spiker, wondering what Putin's relationship is like with the press.
He it would be hard to say that he has a relationship with the press at all. There is a pool, a Kremlin pool, just like a White House pool, that travels around with him. They have some access, and they often will be the best source.
How independent are they?
You know, the media in Russia increasingly, especially the people that would be part of the press pool at the Kremlin, have increasingly become dependent and almost entirely on the government. There are still opposition newspapers, especially, and online venues. They're not going to be traveling that close. And TV is completely under the control of the Kremlin. So you don't hear a lot of dissenting voices. They treat the leader in Russia with far more deference than the American press does, an American president. In fact, the American president would probably welcome the kind of deference that Putin receives from the journalists who cover him, again, who are part of the official press, if you will.
I've heard from other correspondents who came out of Moscow that they understood that they were followed and monitored and bugged. And did you have that experience as the New York Times correspondent there?
I never felt like I was followed, per se, like in a movie, but I assumed always that, you know, there were very few secrets. I think that's true in other countries as well,
mm-hmm.
by the way. But the, I never had any kind of direct harassment that I was aware of. I do know, in fact, just in July when I was up north in the Arctic in Russia, as soon as I showed up in a little village, the guy that was driving me around got a phone call from the FSB wondering what they were doing with an American.
Wow.
So they quickly will be aware of your presence.
All the way up in the Chukchi Sea.
All the way up there. I had another experience traveling down in near Chechnya, right before the Sochi Olympics, where everybody that I interviewed in the story was called in and questioned afterwards.
Even now.
Yes. Mm. So, it's not a welcome or open society to be a reporter in.
The book is The New Tsar, The Rise and Reign of Vladimir Putin, and yes, there are pictures.
Well, I thought I had lost that interview, which I thought was exceptional, and I thought it was pretty fair. I'll wait for the input from our Russian comrades, our friends. See what they think about it, but it seemed to be pretty fair. The last czar or something, the czar. But anyhow, that's on the book stands. People want to pick it up, and so I hadn't planned to run this long an interview on here. But I think you find it very worthwhile if you're the kind of history junkie and news junkie that I am. To close out with this about this Jew Bernays that I've told you about before, and there's been other books I've talked about him. He was really a mind bender and the father of commercial advertising and Madison Avenue and selling people things I don't need and don't want. And also he was instrumental in barnstorming the country for Woodrow Wilson to get the people in a mood for war, because before he went barnstorming around the country and they started selling bonds, the American people weren't interested in World War I. Unfortunately, due to the machinations of this Jew and a lot of other people like that, they talked the American people into this war, which actually was a disaster. It's never ended, really. It gradually became World War II and Hitler and everything and Stalin all that went with it, and everything that's even come out of there, the Cold War and on it goes. So it all started with Bernays, this Jew, barnstorming the country, talking people into going along with the war, go along with Wilson's because Wilson promised he wouldn't take us to war. And he no sooner got elected and he changed his mind, you know. He probably really didn't change his mind at all. He probably had his idea to go to war all along. But if you could trace everything that's happening today, almost through the First World War and on to the Second World War and on and to all our little occupations and so forth. So here's Bernays.
About the history of advertising in America. In 1928, the American Tobacco Company had a problem. Their Lucky Strike brand of cigarettes was one of the fastest growing in the United States, but there was one totally untapped corner of the market: women. Smoking at this time was still seen as a manly activity. Many would have associated it with soldiers on the front lines of World War I, for instance. Women lighting up cigarettes, that was relatively unheard of, and socially, it was certainly taboo.
To break this taboo, American Tobacco turned to a man named Edward Bernays. He was part ad man, part PR guy, and all ego. In the 20s, Bernays had revolutionized the way products were sold in America. Instead of direct advertising, he used techniques lifted from his uncle, Sigmund Freud, to tap into the underlying reasons people had for making the choices they did. So when publishers, for instance, came to him to up their book sales, he did more than just place ads in newspapers. He convinced the leading architects of American homes to build bookshelves into the walls.
He figured a vacuum needs to be filled, and if you had bookshelves in a home, you weren't going to fill it with cereal boxes, you were going to fill it with books.
This is author Larry Tye, who wrote a biography of Bernays. He says Bernays banked on Americans' desire to impress their friends with all the books they owned, even if they had never cracked open any of those books on their shelves. The result was huge sales for publishers.
So he took a very basic behavior and he transformed it to the point where every time I'm in someone's home now and I see a built-in bookshelf, I think that is Eddie Bernays.
American Tobacco most likely knew it would take this sort of outside-of-the-box thinking to reshape Americans' associations with smoking. And Bernays delivered the goods. His first step was to enlist medical professionals. They gave him quotes attesting to the health benefits of smoking, particularly that it made women thinner. Then Bernays pushed those quotes to reporters. But when I sat down with Ty, he told me that journalists and doctors weren't the only ones that Bernays targeted in 1928.
He convinced a guy, a photographer named Nicholas Murray, to ask other photographers and artists to sing the praises of the thin. And Murray said, "I've come to the conclusion that the slender woman who, comma, combining suppleness and grace with slenderness, who instead of overeating sweets and desserts lights a cigarette, has created a whole new standard of female loveliness." And Bernays actually turned that into a slogan: reach for a lucky instead of a sweet. And by doing that, he was tapping into people who he knew helped set the trends in America. So in this case, it was a photographer.
Uh-huh.
In other cases, it was nutritionists and health experts. But to me, the most symbolically wonderful and the most poetic of the ways he went to work was he decided to enlist some of the most extraordinary debutantes in New York society and got these women to sign up for what they thought was striking a blow, not for smoking cigarettes, but for women's liberation.
on Easter Sunday marching down America's Boulevard, which was Fifth Avenue. He got them to light up what he called their torches of freedom. So Easter Sunday, Fifth Avenue, America's leading debutantes lighting up their torches of freedom.
Brilliant. But, you know, what if some competitor, some knockoff brand is capitalizing on all his good work? Some competing tobacco company.
They did, but he increased sales enough for the whole market, and the people who were hiring him already had the lion's share of any market he was going into, that it worked for them. But Bernays actually decided that many women weren't smoking Luckies because the green package with the red bullseye clashed with their favorite clothing. This was an extraordinary notion in two ways. One, that the choice of a cigarette would depend on how it went with your clothing was extraordinary enough. More chutzpah was the notion that he could actually change the taste of women in terms of the color they preferred. And he proceeded to do just that.
Unbelievable.
With Lucky Strikes, he decided that they would go best if the color green, if women were wearing green, and he helped make green the fashion color of the year. He could change people's taste in everything from what they ate to what they wore, and he used every technique that he ever tried in any other format to get women smoking cigarettes.
To stand up for Bernays, as I recall, he made the case that more propaganda, which in those days, in fairness, really meant information, would lead to more informed debate. In other words, you know, both sides could have at it. I remember those poor candy makers. They weren't happy about the Slim is Better campaign, and if I'm not mistaken, Bernays' attitude when they struck back at him was, hey, this is good. This just creates more free publicity.
So you bring up a really important point. Bernays' legacy was the best and the worst of what public relations and propaganda can be. The best was getting more information out there, educating the public. He really did believe in an informed public. The worst was that he didn't want to inform that public with really straight information. He decided to educate the public with only the selected information that benefited his clients.
Did he use his products? Did Bernays smoke?
He had never been tempted to smoke himself, but at the very moment when he was having women march down Fifth Avenue with their torches of freedom, he was telling his young daughters at home, when they saw their mother smoking a cigarette, to try to take the pack of cigarettes, and as he said, break them in half like they were brittle bones and flush them down the toilet. So 50 years later, when he went to work for the American Lung Association trying to wean women off the habit he had created, he said to America, basically, if I had known how dangerous this product was, I would never have helped create the addiction to it. That would have been very convincing if he hadn't left behind in the Library of Congress all his own records showing just how he did know. Tragically, he ignored, and didn't just ignore, covered up the evidence. And tragically, we saw the result as women's rates of lung cancer in America started to catch up to men. At the same time, their rates of buying products from American Tobacco was catching up to men. The question to me is, why would he create these kinds of illusions and misapprehensions about what he was doing and then leave all the papers that prove that he was lying to the Library of Congress, where someday somebody would look at them. And my only answer to that is that he was old enough when he left the papers, and there were so many of them, that he might not have been aware of just how damning his own evidence was on his own lying.
Or perhaps he was even prouder of his ability to manipulate than of his moral compass.
I didn't think anybody could be more cynical about Eddie than I am, but I think that you could absolutely be right.
Well, Gary, thank you for unspinning this truly complex.
Well, you notice that he didn't bring out the World War One thing at all, but the other book I've got on the subject, and I've got the interview someplace in my recordings, brings it all out about his activity in hoodwinking the American people to follow Wilson into that stupid war in Europe, World War One. Well, that's about it for today, boys and girls. I'll be back tomorrow on Tuesday and see if we can dig up some more crapola. Yeah, I'm listening all the time. Over the weekend or over the holidays, I recorded a whole bunch of stuff here. And sometimes it's so much it's a little hard to find the one I'm looking for. And I'll see you tomorrow. 14 words and 5 words.
Every piece of this is man's bullshit. They call this war a cloud over the land, but they made the weather, and then they stand in the rain and say, shit, it's raining!
Let's do that one more time. I like that one.
Every piece of this is man's bullshit. They call this war a cloud over the land, but they made the weather, and then they stand